I'll probably get to it next week for sure. But there's been articles in Time Magazine and in Newsweek that have come right out and said, the Bible very well may be the founding document of this nation. Well, it was. So hopefully we'll get to that. Ezekiel chapter 3, I'll read these verses, beginning in verse 17. Son of man, I have made thee a watchman under the house of Israel. Let me pause. The black regiment were the pastors of the churchmen, of the churches, and they were like watchmen on the wall. And they would watch for danger that was coming in, and they could see it politically, educationally, and so that's what they were. I have made thee a watchman in the house of Israel, therefore hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way, to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit an iniquity, I lay a stumbling block before him. He shall die, because thou hast not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou wilt warn the righteous man, that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned also, thou hast delivered thy soul. Now, it is my opinion, I was just talking to Brother Pardee about this. I personally think that President Obama is a wicked man, and I mean wicked. I think Governor Cuomo is a wicked man. He's just wicked. I believe if Hillary Clinton gets elected, and the polls are shrinking, but I don't believe the polls. I pretty much don't believe much of anything the media puts out, just in case you're wondering. She's a wicked person with a wicked agenda. And she ought to be in jail, not getting ready to go to the White House. But these are wicked people. And back in our nation's founding, when it came up close to the time of the Revolutionary War, the black regiment were the pastors who led their churches to say, we are not going to submit to the government in England any longer. Pick up your guns and fight. And our government now says, we probably want to take your guns. We've come a long way downhill. So I'll just give a little bit of review of what we covered a couple of weeks ago. But the pastors back then believed that defending liberty was the same as defending God's law. We want liberty. Now, we are losing our liberties. I don't know if you watch it closely or not, but people, even Christian businesses, are losing some of their liberties that they ought to have in business. They preached on liberty all the time. There were people who believe today that the churches and the pastors should never mention anything about politics. That was not at all the case in the founding of this nation. There are volumes, I'll mention some later, that are put together of election day sermons and political sermons that were preached from the pulpits of New England back in the founding of this nation, and yet today we're told, no, we shouldn't have anything to do with it. Members of the Black Regiment had a great deal to say about the tyranny of the king and the parliament. Our president is a tyrant, which it's amazing, nobody stops him. He has written more executive orders. I don't know if the president has even come close to writing the executive orders that this man has written. And Cuomo and his inner three oftentimes get together at night to come up with a bill, like the SAFE Act, and then the next, it's voted on, in the morning, nobody's even read the thing. The health care bill that was passed by this administration is like 20-some, I don't know, it's about that thick. Because there's two ladies in our church that have read every word of it. And one lady copied it off first. It took her two full reams of paper to copy it. So how many pages are in a ream? 250? whatever it is. So, you know, it's like, what is it, 500 pages? Although I have a book in my office, I'm not, it's only on one side of the paper, but it is that thick. It's about 5 inches thick. And I got it in this great big giant notebook. So there's a few books out there that are kind of fat. But anyway, the health care bill is. And inside that thing, the first lady I asked, I says, what'd you think when she got done with it? She says, that thing is scary. And that's the only two people that I've known read it all. Well, the politicians didn't even have a chance to read it all, and they had to vote on it. So it's unbelievable. But anyway, the Black Regiment had a great deal to say about tyranny in the king. Reverend Jonathan Mayhew, he was a minister of the West Church in Boston, preached a sermon in 1765 that was in a response to the King's Stamp Act, and he declared that the king had thus forfeited his rightful authority over his American subjects. And in his sermon to the church, he said, "The king is as much bound by his oath not to infringe the legal rights of the people as the people are bound to yield subjection to him. From whence it follows that as soon as the prince sets himself up above the law," sound like anybody you are aware of, "sets himself up above the law, he loses the king in the tyrant. He does to all intents and purposes unking himself by acting out of and beyond the sphere which the English Constitution allows him to move in." I've talked to more than one person in that works in Washington, and I'll say, "How come Hillary's not arrested?" And they go, or it's like, "She's untouchable." And this has been quoted to me more than once. "She's above the law." How in the world can somebody who be above the law be our president? It doesn't even make sense. The Black Regiment were led by the pastors who ultimately said no to the government of England because of the spiritual awakening, the Great Awakening, the great preachers, George Whitefield, Jonathan Edwards, etc., of the Great Awakening. They got out their guns and they said, "You know what, we're just going to have to fight. And some of these things we can't submit." And they did not just automatically submit to the government. We covered some of that in some of their sermons. I won't read all those again. I highlighted a couple things in here, and I wanted to. Some of you may have read Dr. Kennedy's book. How many of you remember James Kennedy? He was on the radio years ago. Okay, good. He and Jerry Newcomb wrote a book, "What If Jesus Had Never Been Born?" And in it, they said this: "The road to America's freedom was paved in large part by the pulpits of New England. Sermons from the colonial era helped to shape the American understanding, and listen, that resistance to tyranny is obedience to God." Now, you don't hear that come across from the pulpits today. What you hear is, you always got to submit to the government. Our forefathers, I'm telling you, the forefathers and godly men that were a part of this country, they didn't believe that. And they preached these Election Day sermons, and they turned their back on the government. The Black Regiment preached liberty so strongly that John Adams said, "The thunder and lightning every Sabbath against George's the third disposition." Almost every Sabbath for a while, it seemed like they were preaching against the government. Thomas Jefferson said, "Pulpit oratory ran like a shock of electricity through the entire colony." Pastor Sam Davis, preaching against cowardice in May 8, 1758, asked his congregation, "Is it not our duty in the sight of God, is it not a work to which the Lord loudly calls us, is to take up our arms for the defense of our country?" And he meant fighting against the government of the Brits, who was tyrannical. Pastor Mayhew in Boston, who himself was a graduate of Harvard, saw the need for American independence for righteousness' sake. He preached against tyranny as a sin from which the people under its opposition had an obligation to rebel. I got to get a copy of it. You guys, any of you guys listen to, who's the preacher that comes on WMH? Oh, he's my favorite radio preacher, Adrian Rogers. Comes on at 8 or 8:30 on the morning. He has a sermon, and they had it on the radio not all that long ago. Maybe it was longer ago than I thought. But anyway, it was entitled, "How to Be a Godly Rebel." I said, "Now that's my kind of sermon. I got to get that thing." And it had to do with how to stand up against the government. Mayhew believed that the Word of God addressed all issues of life, including our political issues. He preached this: "To say that subjects in general are not proper judges when their governors oppress them and play the tyrant and may defend their rights against justice, impartiality, and promote the public welfare is a great treason, not against one single man, but the state, against the whole body politic. 'Tis reason against mankind, 'tis reason against common sense, and 'tis reason against God. And the impetus principle lays the foundation for justifying all the tyranny and opposition that ever any prince was guilty of. That was the normal preaching back then. That was the standard. During the American War for Independence, a Lutheran pastor, he preached, I can't say his last name, M-U-H-L-N-B-B-E-R-G, Muhlenberg or something, from Ecclesiastes 3. That was the guy that took off his coat, and underneath his coat he had an army guy's uniform on. He said, I'm going to step away from the church and I'm going to go defend the country and I'm going to go to war. About 300 people from his church said, we're going with. And they packed up and they went with him. We are defending our rights. Now, not every pastor ripped their black coat off. That's why they were called black coats, the black regiment. Ripped off their black coat and had a military uniform under it. They didn't all recruit like that. But he did, and it worked. And there is still in Washington, at the Capitol, it's not a picture, but anyways, maybe it is a picture. They show him ripping the coat off with his uniform under it. It's in the rotunda. So I say all that to remind you that our nation really is we're in desperate days. And I mean desperate days. This election really could, and you hear this at every election, this is the most important election ever. Well, this could really change the entire course of America. Because you have there are opposing views that are so opposite of each other that it really could change the entire scope of this. I was telling someone earlier today, I was out walking the streets in Rome witnessing to people. It was a nice afternoon. It was beautiful outside. And so I was just walking up and down the streets, handing out gospel tracts and witnessing. I started witnessing to this young couple, mid-20s, I guess. And you know what his first question to me was? What color was Jesus? I'm like, that shocked me. I never heard that. I said, well, nobody really cares. But I said he was a Jew, so I assume he looked like a Jew. Maybe he was color like you are. And I tried to just say that so I could get back to witnessing. The girl was listening and intently, and he wasn't. And when I had the Bible, one of the missionaries was with me. They were coming this way. And so I said, John, you were there, I think. And I said, let me have your Bible, because I only had Romans, John and Romans with me, and then I needed to go to 1 Corinthians. So I showed him something in 1 Corinthians, and you might have heard him say, well, I don't believe that. Did you hear that? Yeah. So I said, well, you will 4 seconds after you die. How I picked four, I have no idea. But anyway, that's what I said. And it's like our whole country is fascinated with racism all of a sudden. That was not the case before President Obama came in. It's unbelievable what's happened. And all these, I guess I'll have to chase a rabbit now. All these kids, even at the high school football games, that are not standing for the pledge but are kneeling down. Doesn't the flag rise above some of this stuff? I don't understand it. Even the professional football players won't stand during the national anthem. They're sending a message. The message that they're sending is not the one I'm receiving, I can tell you that. It's unbelievable. So let me pick up with a little bit about this. What happened at Lexington and Concord. It probably was the most famous Minutemen of all that we remember were those from Lexington. They were from the church in Massachusetts. Their pastor was Jonas Clark. Jonas Clark, Pastor Clark, was a part of the Black Regiment. The battles that began on April 19th of 1775 in Lexington and Concord sparked the American War for Independence. It was that date that the British soldiers first fired on the Minutemen, and it was outside of the church in Massachusetts, called Lexington, Massachusetts. The colonists in that was to become Kentucky, were so impressed by the bravery of those New Englanders that they named one of their cities Lexington in honor of those in Massachusetts. So April 19th was the day that the shot that was fired is the one that you've heard it said in history is the shot that was heard all around the world. The shot that really ignited the lamp for liberty. It was a lamp that has never been extinguished, but it's about to be extinguished. That lamp has been burned around the globe, but it's getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. Throughout the night of April 18th, I'm reading this and I did not write down where I got it from. Anyway, Paul Revere made his famous midnight ride warning, "The British are coming." You've all heard about that. "The British are coming. The redcoats were marching to the sleepy little village of Lexington because two of the greatest early patriots of liberty could be found there, Samuel Adams and John Hancock. These two men were being entertained in the home of the pastor, Jonas Clark, minister of the church at Lexington. At that time, Lexington was a small town with a population of about 700. The British were also interested in that area because they were planning to seize a cache of gunpowder being stored in the neighboring town of Concord. George Bancroft tells us what happened in the wee hours of April 19th. He is a great historian. If you can find his books, you ought to read them. He said at 2 in the morning, this came out of one of Dr. Gibbs' books, Dr. Gibbs Sr. At 2 in the morning, under the eye of the minister, Reverend Jonas Clark, and of John Hancock and Samuel Adams, Lexington Common was alive with the Minutemen, and not with them only, but with the old men who were exempt, except in the case of immediate danger to the town. The roll was called, and a militia and alarm men, about 130, answered to their names. The captain, John Parker, ordered everybody to load with powder and ball, to take care not to be the first to fire. Well, they didn't fire first, but it was the Brits. Speaking of the Lexington Church in Massachusetts, Bancroft said, "How often in that building had they, with renowned professions of their faith, looked up to God as the stay of their fathers and the protector of their privileges. For a century and a half, Christians had been stepping over that parade ground on their way to church for worship. Now they were there defending their right to continue to worship freely." That could happen again. Bancroft went on, "The ground on which they trod was the altar of freedom, and there were to finish the victims. When the two parties, the well-disciplined British Army and the ragtag," I like this, "and the ragtag assembly of the churchmen encountered each other, it became very clear that the Americans were hopelessly outnumbered. So Captain Parker commanded his men to depart. But before they could do so, the battle had begun. The melee that followed, 7 Americans were killed, both old and the young, 9 were wounded, 1/6 of those fighting on the Lexington Green. This battle was the turning point for America. Other patriots saw how Lexington Green was red," it says, quote, "with the innocent blood of their brethren. The British, who lost far more men in their first battle, then marched on to Concord. Among the colonial dead left at Lexington were several old men who could have easily have gone quietly to their graves in comfort of their own homes at some future time." And that's where a lot of people are today. They just assume, I don't want to be bothered. But who's going to stand up? Instead of those to defend their homes and paid the ultimate price for liberty, this was the sacrificial world of the Minutemen. From the 19th of April, 1775, we may venture to predict, will be dated in future history the liberty or slavery of the American world according as a sovereign God shall see fit to smile or frown upon the interesting cause in which we are engaged. That was said by Pastor Clark. He preached it on the anniversary of the battle at Lexington. Samuel Adams examined the field that morning. He proclaimed, "Oh, what a glorious morning it is," because he could see his country's independence hastening on. Adams knew such a carnage would only hasten the day of complete American independence from Great Britain. On that same day, the British and the Americans exchanged gunfire in nearby Concord. Bancroft noted a spiritual dimension to that battle as well. The people of Concord, this is a cool story, of whom about 200 appeared in arms that day, derived their energy from their sense of divine power. Thus looking to God as their sovereign brought the fathers to their pleasant valley, this controlled the loyalty of the sons, and this made the name of Concord venerable throughout the world. When word of these battles spread to the towns near and far, other Minutemen came pouring in from other places to help their brethren, Lexington and Concord. George Bancroft noted the men of Dedham, even the old men, received their minister's blessings as they went forth in such numbers that scarce one male between 16 and 70 was left at home. I mean, these guys believed in liberty, man. The Dedham minister was another member of the Black Regiment, encouraging his congregation to fight for liberty. The church was clearly the hub of colonial society during our nation's battle for independence. The church is no longer the hub of society. The church has failed. Jonas Clark, the pastor at Lexington who lost many of his congregation on the town green that fateful day, said of the British troops in his sermon on the anniversary, this is part of his message, "And this is the place where the fatal scene begins. They approach with the morning's light and more like murderers and cutthroats than the troops of a Christian king, without provocation, without warning, when no war was proclaimed, they drew the sword in violence upon the inhabitants of this town, and with a cruelty and barbarity which would have made the most hardened savage blush, they shed innocent blood. Yonder field can be witnessed the innocent blood of our brethren slain, and from thence does their blood cry out unto God for vengeance from the ground. There the tender fathers bled, and there the beloved son bled." And then they had this. There were Minutemen who, they were led by their pastor during a battle between the parish parishioners. So that would be like me saying to you guys, "Come on, guys, let's go get our guns. We got to go fight a war." That's exactly what happened. Literally exactly what happened. Pastor Caldwell, they ran out of... You guys ever shoot a black and powder? Now they make them, you know, you can buy bullets. There's called Sabot, and they got that. Okay, but back when I first started with mine, you dump the powder. First, you had to measure it. Those things were, they were fun to hunt and shoot, but they were a pain at the same time. Anyway, you take your powder, and you had to measure it because you had to get about the same amount in every time you're shooting all over. So you dump it in. Then you'd put this patch in there, and you'd get it centered over the top of the barrel just right. And then you'd put your ball in it. And you had a little starter rod, and you'd start it with that. And then you'd take your big rod and you'd ram it down. Well, those patches that went over the top of the, between the powder and the ball, they ran out of those. So during the battle, when the Minutemen ran out of wadding for their muskets, running out of wadding was as bad then as running out of bullets today would be. Reverend Caldwell did not hesitate to sacrifice their hymnals, tearing out the pages and handing them American soldiers. And you know one of the great hymn writers that we sing from? Mr. Watts, they would say, "Give me Watts." You know what that meant? I need more wadding. That's what that meant. I thought that was a cool story. I like that story. And according to the historian, he said, the Minutemen and Watts, they won the battle that day. Now, there's a lot more that I could say about the Minutemen and their black regiment. I really like that part of our history. I find it exciting to read, but I find it very loyal to the cause of liberty. We've lost that loyalty. Whole books have been written about the influential sermons that they have. Dr. Ellis from Louisiana State University has compiled a 2-volume set of political sermons of the American founding era. 2 volumes. They were from 1730 to 1805. Dr. Harry Stout, professor at Yale University, researched the black regiment sermons that had never been published, and he issued it in his book called The New England Soul. I mean, these are sermons, political sermons about the tyranny, and we're not going to submit to the government. We have seen, then, the 7th thing that every Christian should know about the founding of America, and it was that the black regiment, especially the New England clergy, along with their faithful church members, the Minutemen, helped to provide the moral and spiritual and also the actual force that was needed for America to choose liberty and to ultimately attain that goal. John Thornton once put it this way: to the pulpit, the Puritan pulpit, we owe the moral force which won our independence. It was from the church pulpits. Now that was the 7th thing, and I wanted to say more about that, and I could go on and on about that, quite honestly, but I won't. America was blessed. Look at Proverbs chapter 22, if you would, with me, please. And then if we get to it, we'll get to Psalm 35, and I'm not sure we're going to get to it today. America was blessed to have Christian patriots of independence. And it was the church, because it was the hub of the community. By the way, a few years ago now, a church wanted to buy a piece of property in Long Island to to build, to expand their church on. They had a little church, and this property was adjacent to their church. And they thought, this is perfect. It went up for sale. They had the cash to buy it, so they went to buy it. Then somebody else came along and said, we don't want to buy it. So the town board got together and would not sell the property to the church, even though they were there first. And here was their ruling. They wanted to build a church. The other company, this is Long Island, New York. The other people wanted to build a playground. And they thought that a playground would be more valuable to the community than a church. That's pathetic. That's absolutely pathetic. In the founding of America, the church was the center of the community. Now, I have said, and I'll probably say it again, I think as a family, and we all have busy lives and our kids are involved in all kinds of things, but our schedules should revolve around the schedule of the church. You look at a church calendar and say, okay, we're going to do these events around these days. And can I don't know. People do things that irritate me, I guess. I'll just shut up about that. America was very blessed. But let me give you the eighth thing, and then this, I won't spend a lot of time on this because I'll get to it on the ninth thing. The eighth thing that you need to know about the founding of America is this. Biblical Christianity was the driving force behind the key leaders of the American Revolution. Proverbs 22:1 says, a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than gold and silver. Now it says a good name is rather to be chosen. If you will study, and I'll give you some because I'm not going to say a lot about them, but if you study the history of men like George Washington, our first president, you'll find out that he was a good man. And people that knew him had a high level of respect for him. There was a movie that came out not that long ago, it's been a few years now, and it depicted George Washington as a foul-mouthed man because most people in the military are that way, and somebody who cheated on his wife. But there is no historical fact that he was either foul-mouthed or cheated on his wife. And there is every reason to believe that he never did either one of them. There are several copies of letters that he had written back to his wife. Hollywood likes to embellish and superimpose things. But you know what's sad? A lot of people will watch a movie and believe it. I recommend you don't get your theology from Hollywood. Others say that he was a deist. That appears to be false as well, because there are copies of his prayer journals. And it would be hard to believe that a man could pray like he prayed and believed what he believed and written in his own handwriting that would say that he was a deist. Others, like Samuel Adams, called him the lightning rod of the Revolution. John Edgemore said, Samuel Adams did more than any other American to arouse opposition against English rules in the colonies. The Christian leaders said back then, don't submit to government. We don't have that spirit today. The government back then didn't do the outright evil, even as our government does today, but they took away people's liberties. Our government takes away people's liberties and they impose evil. And nobody's still standing up against them. The guy that wrote his biography, John Miller, said this, Samuel Adams cannot be understood without considering the lasting impacts George Whitefield's preaching at Harvard had during the Great Awakening had on him. He said, George Whitefield was one of the greatest preachers that's ever been in America. And one of our founding fathers, his preaching influenced him tremendously. Patrick Henry was a godly man. These three men are godly, godly men. His phrase that everybody knows, give me liberty or give me death, was said in the context that we need to go to war against the government of England. That's why he said that. Now, because I'm going to say more about that in this next section, I'm going to skip to it. What is considered to be the birth certificate of America? The Declaration of Independence. Are you aware, this is my ninth thing, that biblical Christianity played a significant role in development of our nation's birth certificate? Now, I'm going to skip, I put quite a bit of research into this, but I'm going to skip way ahead here. I want to get to this. What are the biblical roots of the Declaration of Independence? A few decades ago, there were two political professors. The first guy is Charles, I don't know, Flynemet, however you say his name. And the other one is Donald Lutz. You know, why can't they just have a nice four-lettered last name? But they can't. They did this really groundbreaking, massive study where they studied 15,000 documents, including thousands of books that were written during America's founding era, which is 1760 to 1805, 1810. They analyzed their political content. They studied political volumes, they studied manuscripts, they studied pamphlets, they studied newspaper articles. And you know what they determined? What the number one source of the roots of the Declaration was, after all the 15,000 things that they looked at, they concluded this. The Bible, with 34% of all the citations that were in their study, they said 34% of them were taken out of the Bible. You cannot get around the Bible influence on our birth certificate. The Bible was the number one quoted book, according to those. And this isn't just a one or two thing study. This is 15,000. After the Bible, the top three sources citing the political writings were this. I don't know how to say the Frenchman's name, but anyway, 8.3%. Mr. Blackstone, William Blackstone, you heard of him? Was referenced 7.9%. The fourth one, so you got the Bible, Montesquieu, Blackstone, and the next one was John Locke, 2.9%. Now do the math. Of all the citations that they could tell that came from the Declaration, if you add the three godly men together plus the Bible, it's 53% of all citations were taken from biblical sources. That is the roots of the Declaration of Independence. All three of those men, and I'm not going to go into detail on them, all three of those men were professing Christians and had biblical views on politics. Government and the laws were influential directly and positively by the Word of God. I don't hear our president ever say, well, we've been looking at the Bible and we think this is the right law to make. That's what they did back then. They said, well, this is what the Bible says. This is what Mr. Blackstone said, and he studied the Bible. This is what Mr. Locke says, and he studied the Bible. Many Americans today are taught that our revolution ideas came from European Enlightenment thinkers. That's wrong. The Enlightenment thinkers was an 18th century European philosophy movement that was characterized by rationalism, and it was strongly bent toward learning, education. Many of the Enlightenment thinkers were skeptics with regard to religion, and they looked to experience for their social and political philosophies. Now there were, and they still are, two distinct Enlightenment thinkers today. Those who are skeptics and those who continue to acknowledge the Word of God. It was the Christian Enlightenment thinkers who influenced our founders. They went to the Bible. They weren't people like Voltaire, who had forsaken God. Now we have two distinct philosophies today. Secularism, which is a world view based on experience and what you think and knowledge, your own knowledge, and a biblical worldview. We don't call them Enlightenment thinkers today, the first group. You know what we call them? Progressive. We're progressive. They even talk about this in just the common world, away from the political venue. Well, we've really evolved. Look at same-sex people can get marriage today. We're being progressive. Hillary Clinton, not that long ago, I heard her say, our founding fathers would not have wanted me around. Well, why in the world do we? by their philosophy. Now, you need to hear this. My son Dan gave me a CD one. No, it wasn't that long ago. Maybe I can find it. He said, Dad, you need to listen to this. So I listened to it twice. The guy starts out his CD with this comment. It was a political speech. Dan's up pretty good on that stuff. And the guy started with this. The liberals or the progressives are wrong on every single issue. I thought to myself, well, it doesn't seem possible you can be wrong. That would be 100% of the time. I says, it doesn't seem possible that they can be wrong 100% of the time. But I will tell you, as I think about Mrs. Clinton from the time that she was Secretary of the State under her husband, she wasn't under her husband, but when she was Secretary of the State and when she worked with her husband, Bill, and when she was Senator of New York, you know, I can't think of one positive thing that woman has ever done. So I think, and when I'm listening to this CD, I'm thinking, wow. And I can't think of one good thing President Obama has done. He's a good liar. So is she. I can't think of one positive thing that they've done good. So I'm thinking, how can they be wrong on every single issue? How is that possible? Go ahead. I forgot that one. Yes, she's right. You're right. You know why they're wrong on every issue? Their fundamental philosophy is flawed. It is. They don't go to the Bible for their philosophy. And they use two words that you are very well aware of. Tolerance. You've got to tolerate everybody. You cannot be judgmental. What's that? Oh, yeah, they hate Christians. Is that what you said? Is that Christians? Oh, man, no kidding. Yeah, that's one thing they won't tolerate. You know what they won't tolerate? Our intolerance. That's what they won't tolerate. But because their view is you have to... Remember Baltimore, Maryland? Oh, by the way, with the thing going on in North Carolina again, isn't it awful? People are crazy. George Soros funds a lot of that too, by the way. You might want to check him out. He's an evil, evil, evil person. But anyway, the reason in Baltimore that the mayor, I forget her name, had the people, the policemen, stand down and let these people, here's the other word, express themselves, that's their mentality. So if everybody has a right to express themselves, and a terrorist decides to go somewhere in a mall or in a church or in a school or a restaurant and blow somebody up, he's just expressing himself. A guy rapes a woman or a child because he's expressing himself. You don't have a right to do that. Now that's judgmental, see? And they can't tolerate that. So you have to tolerate everybody and everything. And all views and their philosophy are equal. That's flawed thinking. As a matter of fact, it's somewhat insane thinking. And we say they're crazy, but in some ways they literally are really crazy. So because the foundation of their philosophy is so flawed that these people are wrong almost, it seems like, 100% of the time because they are tolerant. And you've got to let people express themselves, and we're progressing. We're not progressing, we're degressing. So anyway, I listened to the CD, and I got to tell you something. After about 45 minutes, two times, I was pretty convinced. They're wrong on every single issue. Now let me show you how this works on some things that you all are aware of. Abortion. Where did you get your belief that abortion was wrong? The Bible. What don't they reference? The Bible. What makes you think homosexuality is wrong? The Bible. What makes you think transgenderism, or whatever they call it, is wrong? The Bible. Does the Bible tolerate everything? You were here earlier, and those of you that weren't will be here later, but we'll read a passage from Leviticus chapter 20. The law didn't tolerate everything, I can tell you that. And it did not accept everything. And we don't have to accept everybody's views on things. And that's another thing they want us to do. Well, what's right for you is right for you, and what's right for me is right for me. We can't live like that. Society can't function with that kind of thinking. And here's also how it works. I believe same-sex marriage is wrong. I don't even think it's wrong. I think it's a sin and an abomination against the holy God. Now, that is judgmental, and I know that. I judge them to be wrong. I judge people. Mary McNamara made a good statement the other day. We were chit-chatting, and we were talking about the transgenders. And I never thought of it this way, but she made it so simple. It's like, how did I not think of that? She said, a guy says he's feeling his feminine side. Yep. And then she said this, how does he know what a feminine side is? He's never felt it before. How could he? He's been a man. I thought, you know what? That's pretty good. She's right. I judge that. I'm not going to tolerate everybody's behavior. You're not all here, I know that. I'll tell you what, I joined a militia to fight the government. You say you're wrong. I'm not convinced I'm wrong, obviously. And I think there's some others that would do it. Now, I don't think everybody would, because we're not all united like they were after the Great Awakening swept New England states and said, we're just not going to tolerate this anymore. We don't have that fire and that zeal like our forefathers had. We do have, though, a biblical view. We're not tolerant. We're not all inclusive. And because of that, our philosophy, and I'm assuming you believe like me, and their philosophy clash. They really, really clash. They were Enlightenment people back then. Today we call them progressive. As I mentioned Mrs. Clinton, President Obama, I can't think of any, I think he's been wrong 100% of the time. It's hard to believe you can be wrong 100% of the time. But it seems like he was successful in that. Their philosophies, secular, humanistic, experience, we know more than God, it causes them to be wrong. It's a flawed philosophy. The other thing that they really lean on is higher learning. Higher learning, because of the way they control the universities, and I'm pro-education. We have a co-op here, okay? I'm pro-education. But they have hurt as much as they have helped. And on a moral level, they have hurt more than they have helped. Our enemies foresaw that coming. I have a book I put in the library. If you want to read a flat-out boring book, pick up the book in there called, what's the name of it? Marxist Ministers, something like that. Anyway, it is totally boring, but it was a mandatory reading when I was in college. But anyway, it said in there, the Russians had said years ago, we don't have to destroy America. America will destroy itself from within. Jimmy had a line in the play last night that pointed right to that. It was the first thing that came to my mind when I read through that. The educational system has destroyed the minds of our young people. They've been lied to. They've been taught false doctrine, like evolution, but it goes on up beyond that. They've been taught tolerance and acceptance. They want to remove God from all areas of life. What's been the result of that? Oh, North Carolina, which I've watched on the news earlier this week, but last night I turned it on and said, I've had enough of this. Baltimore, Ferguson, Missouri, that's the result. Now, I'm not going to say much about those three guys. I'll come back maybe and pick up some more of this lesson next week. But Blackstone, his commentaries, and he's got a several volume, they're worth looking into. They used to be, I don't know if you know this or not, they used to be mandatory reading for all law students because they were based on the Bible. They're not mandatory reading any longer, which I think is an absolute shame. Anyway, my time is up. It's been up for 3 minutes, but that's all right. Well, Lord, as we think about where we are as a nation, we're so divided. But we go back and look where we came from. The roots of our birth certificate, over 50% of the citations were biblical. 34% were right out of the Bible. And where we are today, it's appalling. Mr. Lincoln said we were the beneficiary of your blessings. But I could not help it the other day when I did my devotions, where I read where the Bible said, "The crown has fallen from off thy head." That's us. That's us as a nation. Lord, I pray that as we get prepared as a nation to vote, not only for our president, but there's several other elections, even local. God, would you raise up some godly leaders, people that would hold Christianity and the Bible in high esteem? We need them. I'm not saying we deserve them, but we would ask you to be merciful to us one more time, because we need them. And as we continue to look at our founding of this country, just to study it, what a blessing. But to see to where we are, what a travesty. So Lord, our prayer is for godly leaders, and help us to see our Christian heritage. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, God bless you. We'll get ready for our 11 o'clock service. Those of you that are here at 8:30, we'll see you tonight. We'll be back in